Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello, this is Tim Reedy for the America Magazine podcast for the week of March 2nd. I'm joined this week by editorial director Karen Sue Smith. Welcome, Karen.
Hi, thank you for inviting me. I'm glad to be here.
Now, Karen has an article in the current issue called The World by Chair, which is part of our travel and pilgrimage issue. And this article is written for those who perhaps would like to travel somewhere but don't have the time right now, or perhaps have traveled to a place that they want to revisit. And it's all about reading and different ways that you can visit this place without actually visiting it. Now, Karen, maybe you can talk a little bit about your approach to travel. You've done a lot of traveling over the last 10, 20 years. How do you pick a place where you want to visit?
That's an interesting question. Mm-hmm. It depends, first of all, if I'm going alone or if I'm going with someone else, because whenever you travel with someone, you have to take their interests and their friends and their likes and dislikes into account. If you're traveling alone, though, you don't have to, and you can make friends more easily, but it's not as fun in some aspects, and a lot of people just don't like to travel alone. So basically, I look at a map or think about books, or I see something in a travel section of the newspaper that sparks an interest. I think of some place that I've never been or some place I'd like to go back to. That's how I do it.
Now, your article focuses, as I said, about, you know, looking at places from afar, you know, reading about them, watching movies, reading books about them, novels. But we thought maybe today we could talk about some of the trips you've actually taken and some of your experiences. One I thought we could start with was a coast-to-coast walk you did in England a number of years ago from St. Bee's Head in the west of England to Robin Hood's Bay in the east. Now, how long did this take you?
This is coast-to-coast walk is quite a famous walk in the northern part of England, and it's 200 miles, basically, which does not include you're getting lost, which I seem to get lost quite a bit. It does not include getting to and from wherever you stay the night onto the path, if you can find the path the next morning, that kind of thing. It's a little bit like a scavenger hunt some days. But it takes 2 weeks if you're not trying to run it or whatever. And I did it in two different segments because I did it 1 week one year and another week another year, and with two different people, as it turns out. But anyone of regular ability could do the walk. You carry a little pack. There are other ways you can do it, but it's basically set up for a two-week walk.
Now, as you describe in this little description of your trip that you've given me, one of the reasons that you enjoyed this trip is because you're walking from place to place rather than driving or taking a train. What is it about walking that presents a unique travel experience?
Well, it's a kind of a do-it-yourself thing, and you begin to establish a relationship with the land of a place. I'm someone who's lived on big farms. I'm someone who's lived in cities. But getting your feet wet, so to speak, experiencing the climate of a place, being outdoors and seeing what time it gets dark, what time it gets light, how wet and soggy it really is, watching the fog come in every day in the Lake District, for example, where you just really can't see. You have to situate yourself so that you're not on the edge of a cliff when it comes in. that kind of thing. And then seeing rural people, because you stay in people's homes. A lot of the places along the coast-to-coast walk are not populated. They're very thinly populated. There are two huge national parks as part of it, Dartmoor, and I actually forget the other park right now. But two big parks, and both of them going toward the moors or in the moors. So you actually get a sense of the land, a sense of the place, a sense of the mood of the place, how different the moors are from the Lake District, for example. And then you get to talk to the people, local people. I remember asking somebody once whose house I was in, have you ever taken this walk? And she and her husband just laughed, like, why would we? Why would anyone do this? And yet thousands of people do. And, of course, the English are great walkers. You also situate yourself into a long history of English walkers from Wordsworth, who used to walk 40 miles in a day and who lived in the Lake District, to all the rambling societies, or they call them ramblers or rambling societies and clubs all over the country. It's really fun. You can see them coming.
Now, one of the things that we were discussing before is that when you travel, you try not to stay in American hotels. Now, on this trip in particular, the walk across England, you were actually staying in people's homes, correct?
Yes, for the most part. I stayed maybe in two inns the rest of the time in people's homes. And what you do is, because this is the kind of walk it is, and again, this was a while ago that I did it. I don't know if it's changed now or not, but you get a little list of people who will open their homes, and you contact them when you get onto the route in the morning, and if you're near a phone. That's the other thing. There's not phones every place or phone booths every place. But you call and try to make a reservation for that night. And if it's full, you have to try someplace else. So it's a slightly precarious. Yes, I try never to stay in an American-style hotel anywhere, because I'm traveling to get the flavor of another place, a different place. And I don't want to just be served up the same kind of fare that's usual and that's at home for me.
You've shown me pictures, for example. You recently went to Japan. And that's a place where the hotels are, it's really a unique experience. It's very different from our way of the accommodations in this country.
Yes, it's markedly different. I even stayed in an antique hotel at one point. But the Japanese hotels that I stayed in are all called ryokans, and they're all run by Japanese people. They tend to have mostly Japanese guests. Many Americans or Westerners do not stay in these kinds of hotels. In some of the rooms that I was in, the walls are very, very thin. They're rice paper. You sleep on a tatami mat. In the antique hotel, I actually was on a room and board plan, and so I was served traditional meals. One of them was cooked on a tiny little cooking apparatus right at the table, and it starts with a leaf being placed on there. And I didn't really know what I was supposed to do, and I somehow burnt up the meal, to the horror of the little woman who was serving me. And it was very funny. She was horrified, but I thought it was hilarious. And other eating experiences in a country that go with the place that you stay. One time I was served something that looked to me basically like a twig, and I wasn't sure if I was supposed to eat it or just admire the beauty of it, because in a lot of Japanese, the Japanese aesthetic is that beauty is very important. And so when you eat, you sit by a garden, this kind of thing, and you always have beauty all around you. And of course, so what I did basically was I looked at the people next to me to see if they had the same kind of twig looking thing in there and if anyone was eating it. And so when I saw this woman pop it into her mouth, I thought, oh, this must be food. So I popped it into my mouth, and I'm telling you, it was a twig. The other thing is, you sit at very low tables, and if you're a Westerner, I'm a middle-aged person now, and so my legs would go completely to sleep. And when I'd try to stand up, I could hardly get up from the table. Mm-hmm. Because you're not used to sitting with your legs all straight out in front of you.
So we've talked about the trip you did in England. This was 25 years ago or so, and Japan, which is more recent. But I thought we'd look at one of your trips to Western Europe. Portugal is a place you visited recently. You pick a few towns that you visited. You've given me a list here. Lisbon, the capital. But then you also pick a couple of country towns, a university town. How did you go about picking those places?
Yeah, I've traveled so much now, I've pretty much decided what I like. And everybody, isn't the same as I am. But I just want to suggest this to people who are listening as a possibility. If you haven't tried this, you might want to try it. I find that because I'm coming from a large city, New York, that I can very easily go to another large city. And so the obvious cities, Paris, Rome, Lisbon, the capital cities, big, big, interesting cities. And some of that is because I'm not really in vacation, relaxation mode yet. Sometimes I work so hard just to get on the vacation that I'm hardly rested or anything like that. When I take off, I'm usually half exhausted. So I go to a city, and I start with my guidebooks and maps and all this kind of thing, and I'm really into culture, et cetera, et cetera, and I do my best with that city. Then, as I begin to relax and get into the vacation a little bit more, I tire of having to look at a map for everything, and I kind of tire of public transportation after a while, even though I tend to love that in general, because you can see people, you can observe and meet people. But I go to a smaller place. So I've gone from Rome to Spoleto. I've gone from Lisbon to a smaller town in a different regional landscape. I went toward Spain from Lisbon. Instead of going down to the beach area, I went over towards Spain and went to a little town called Évora, which had a lot of Roman ruins and everything. It was completely different from Lisbon. And I really enjoyed it. And from there, went to the former capital and a university town where the university, one of the oldest universities in Europe, sits on a huge hill. And I stayed in a castle, a palace there, actually, because in Spain and in Portugal, as you probably know, they have taken all sorts of historic landmarks and turned them into inns and hotels for tourists. And so they've preserved them in that way. Some of them are churches, some of them are castles, some of them are just wonderful mansions and estates. This one was an actual palace and was quite spectacular. So I really enjoyed seeing a different kind of town than either Lisbon or Évora. Then for the fourth place that I went, and this is unusual that I would pick four. Usually I pick two or three. But because I'd never been to Portugal before, I did this. And I was going up the coast, so to speak. And this worked with the transportation. So I took a train to a tiny town called Pinhão. It looks like Pinhão, in the wine-growing area. Now, port is the big thing that Portugal, you know, Portugal, you see the connection.
Never thought about it, but it makes sense.
Yes, well, there are two big rivers up there, and then the river valleys are all the wineries and port manufacturers, and the towns make all their money from it. Well, I stayed at the estate of one of these wine makers where the Pinhão River and the Douro River wines, or the Douro Valley wines, are quite famous, world-renowned, stayed right there. And so that was a wonderful, wonderful place. And the town was tiny. There wasn't much to do. And that's exactly what I'm looking for toward the end of any of my trips. I'm looking for not too much to do. I don't have to use any map. I can just go out and wander around. If a dog follows me, I don't worry about it. You can take river trips. I paint. I'm getting all relaxed now. I care a lot more about what food I'm drinking and what wine I'm drinking. And in terms of budget traveling, I've found that it's much better, just budget-wise, to skimp in a big city and take something more meager in terms of accommodation, and to spend your money to splurge in the outlying places, and you will get something fantastic. Otherwise, you can get something very mediocre for a lot of money in a city.
Right, right. And you're not going to spend a lot of time in the hotel to begin with.
No, not at all. You'll be out in the town. And so when you go to a place like this place where we stayed, which was just really nice, we really enjoyed it, and we could just stay right there. I painted a lot of scenes just of things in the hotel, bougainvillea, and from the hotel, all the various vistas that we had, because this is a very old hotel called the Vintage House and just sprawls along. It's right on the river. There are boats right there. You can take little walks every day. You can, you know,
that's great. Now, how do you resist the temptation? This is something I face when I travel, is to try to do too much, because you're in a place for a limited amount of time. Even if you're there for the country for 2 weeks, you can't do it all. How do you resist the temptation to just go, go, go?
Well, that's easy for me. Even when I was young and in my 20s, I watched other people spend a day here, a day there, 2 days here, 2 days there. And what I basically saw them do is spend most of their time getting from place to place.
Yeah.
And I actually, as a traveler, I mean, I'll confess that I don't actually like getting from place to place. I just want to be there. I'm that way with friends. I just want to have friends. I hate making them. I like
that's
actually
a good analogy.
Knowing everybody already, you know. And so it's like that. I love to go to a place. That's one of the reasons I do so much armchair preparation. And I love to extend the trip. And that's why I do so much armchair afterward. I love to go back to a place. But I tend to travel with people who don't necessarily. They're all still out to see the rest of the world. But I'm not a flitter. I'm someone who likes to dig in and sink deeply. And so it's more my temperament in some ways to not jump across the top of something to say I've been there, or even to just get the lay of the land. I can get that through reading films and other ways and talking to people, looking at maps, that kind of thing. Literature, that helps you get the sense of it. But I like to go back and go back. I like to go on the back roads. I'm not, even when I stay in, for example, a beautiful place. I've been to Bellagio. This is one of the beautiful places on Lake Como that you can go. One of the beautiful places in the world. Usually you fly into Milan to get over there. But in Bellagio, which is built up on the side of a hill and looks over the lake on two sides, there are all these little back roads you can take. at back paths, and these are the ones that the people who live there take. This is how they get from place to place. I've actually followed a couple of people just to see, like, where are they going? Where do they live? What's over here? You know, what's it? And that's where you find yourself walking in a little tiny church procession. You know, I found myself in all kinds of things like that by not trying to see everything, but trying to settle into the place where I am.
Now, as I said before, you brought a list of some of the places you've been over the last 20 years or so. And a lot of places on this list are in Western Europe, France, Spain, Italy, Amsterdam. We've also spoken before about your love of art, which you just mentioned. You're an artist. Is the artistic heritage of Western Europe, is that one of the reasons that you keep going back to these places?
Yes, it is. I haven't always been an artist, although I've always been interested in art. I've been interested in art since I very first saw my first museum and since I took the first class as a college student that introduced art history to me. If I had it to do all over again, or if I had had means, for example, I probably would have gone into art history. I just love that. But only recently have I realized that I actually can make art myself and that I have a little talent in that area. But I love seeing art and seeing a culture through art. And it was the basic opening up of the world of Western civilization to me through art and through, this will make a connection for you, through religion, art and music and religion. And we had a book by someone named Fleming called Art, Music, and Ideas that we studied. And I was in a block class in three semesters. I feel like it was 3 years. But that was the most profound learning experience I had as a college student. And this was just an undergraduate class. But it really did explore music, literature, art, and ideas. And the literature, tangentially, because you have quite a bit of literature in your curriculum. But it brought those together so that you could see that Romanticism affected, for example, all of these arts. That different ideas, modernism, affected all of these arts and in what ways it did. And so when I very first, as a young 20-something, went to Europe, I think I was 23, I had graduated and been working for 2 years, I could not wait to go and see my roots, so to speak. I don't have ethnic roots. My family's been here forever, and so I didn't grow up with any of those stories of what ethnicity we are. I have, you know, very little idea what we are. I didn't grow up with any of those stories. And so I went to see history as I knew it, Western history, where it started, all these kinds of things. I was just bowled over by it, and I'm still bowled over by it. And I realize that these places are no longer particularly exotic. People, young people today go to South America, they go to Patagonia, they go to Cambodia, they go to Kathmandu. But people of my age pretty much went to Western Europe, and I still really love to go back and go back and go back.
Now maybe we can end by talking about, you know, of course we're in tough economic times right now. People may be nervous about traveling, about spending money, but you did it when you were young and presumably didn't have a lot of money. What can you do to kind of to travel on a budget?
I've actually never had a lot of money, I mean, to be honest. And when I first went, I traveled on a shoestring, and I'll just give you the real raw data. I saved up $880. This was in the mid-70s, and I made it last for a year and a half, and wow. I did that by working. I've never been anyone to be afraid of working, and I've never had anyone to ask me to ask for money, and so I always had to make it myself. And it's very easy to get a work permit and to work in other countries, or at least it was in that day and time. And I worked on a farm in Denmark. I worked in a huge contracting plant in London. And I worked as a nanny and English teacher to a little four-year-old girl in Paris. Those were my jobs.
Wow.
And I would save up my money, and then I know how to spend my money, too. I splurged after working my first summer in London. I splurged and spent all the money I had saved, virtually, at the Edinburgh Music Festival, where I went to three events every day and took little bus tours of historic homes and estates and things like that all around that area every day. I just going and devouring that town. Relationship with two young men during that time, and it was wonderful fun. One of them was a member of a dancer in the Royal London Folk Dancing Society. His mother was a florist. And so I was in the enviable position in my youth hostel of every time he was in a performance, I got a box seat at Victoria and Albert Hall. His mother, through his mother, he could get a discount on candy and flowers. I would always get an orchid and a big thing of candy. I mean, it was spectacular. It was a great date. And he also loved to walk. And so he and I, every single weekend, his name was Brian, we would go on these paths, the footpaths, all over London. I don't know if you realize that there are footpaths behind all the streets of London. Mm-hmm. And you can feel like you're out in Mississippi or some other country in a rural area all through London. Because London is a bunch of little boroughs that have all grown together, and they have retained every footpath. And so the country is crisscrossed by footpaths, and the city too. And you can literally walk 20, 30 miles, and you hardly see another person except people who are on that walk right through London today.
Well, that's neat, and we want to thank Karen Sue Smith for joining us for our podcast. And you're right down the hall, so hopefully you can come back again soon. And you've given me the travel bug, so I'm going to go research some of these places myself.
Okay, great.
I want to thank you for joining us for this week's edition of the American Magazine Podcast. Just a reminder that you can respond to our conversations by going to americamagazine.podbean.com. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.